But dude averages 18 yards after catch.
We get it. When you're passionate about something, you go all in. You live entirely in that world. That's exactly how Graybar is about renewable energy projects.
He's all fourth quarter, such a sleeper.
Join our league of clean energy at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Whether you want to
buy, buy, buy
in a bear market or
sell, sell, sell
in a bull market, Jim Cramer can help you become a better investor. Mad Money, weeknights 6 Eastern. Listen to CNBC on the Odyssey app.
Welcome back, folks. Really, recently, President Biden approved $500 million arms package for Ukraine. But really, the most important question is, where do we stand today? What is the status of this war, and where do we see it going in the very near future? Daniel DePetra's Defense Priorities Fellow joins us. He authored a piece that said why neutrality is the best course for Ukraine, and he lays out a lot of important details moving forward, and he joins us. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Daniel, where does this $500 million arms package really come into play here? I mean, it seems as though in many respects it was symbolic of the Biden administration trying to prove that there's still going to be this commitment, and they're still trying to hold together the West relative to its commitment to Ukraine. How do you see this?
Yeah, so this latest $500 million tranche of military aid is really nothing new. I mean, the administration has been sending, you know, the Ukrainians hundreds of millions of dollars every 2 months or so. And this, of course, is an extension of what Congress authorized last year, which was about $60 billion in assistance. And that has essentially lasted for the last 12 months. And when Trump comes in January, he'll have another $3.8 billion on the table that he can spend until that assistance is finally out. And, you know, and then, of course, the question is, does Trump go back to Congress and ask for more military aid? And, you know, the Ukrainians are obviously very concerned about Trump not doing that. So that's where we are. And it's basically another example of Biden trying to provide Ukraine with the assistance it needs to keep with the territory that it has as Trump comes in.
As I was reading your article, you know, it's the war in Ukraine enters its fourth year in late February. And I reflected, I'm like, oh, my God, it's been 4 years already. And I got to imagine a lot of other people get slapped in the face with that same reality when they start reading it.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'll be perfectly honest with you, Newell. When this war happened back in February 2022, you know, myself, among others who kind of observed Russian military capabilities, kind of assumed that this war would be over within, you know, a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months at the latest. Because, you know, looking at the balance sheet, the Russians had an extraordinary amount of people that they could throw into the fight. They have a population four times the size of Ukraine, so they have more men that they can enlist. But the Ukrainians, you know, thanks to our assistance and thanks to, you know, to some extent, the European assistance. But first and foremost, thanks to the Ukrainians themselves, that they've been able to really bloody Russia's nose over the last 3 years. You know, that does not at all mean that the situation on the ground is necessarily great for Ukraine at the moment, because it isn't. But, you know, looking back, this war has certainly gone on far longer than many people assumed when it first began.
The most recent happenstance of shutting off the pipeline, is that still the case? And what is the what are the downstream implications of saying?
Yeah, you know, there's been an assumption, I think, and a suspicion that when Trump comes in, that he will, if not completely shut down the pipeline of weapons to Ukraine, that will, you know, decrease the amount of assistance that Washington is willing to give. I know there's several reports that say that one way that Trump plans to coerce Ukraine into negotiations is to basically read them the Riot Act and say, you know, if you don't cooperate in my diplomatic initiative, we're going to, you know, decrease your aid. I don't know if that's true or not, quite frankly. I mean, there's a lot of reports that we that we can read, but I don't think anybody really knows what Trump is going to do. And quite frankly, I don't think Trump knows what he's going to do at this point. It really, everything is open in the air. And when people assume what Trump is going to do, I always kind of remind them that this is a man who values kind of unpredictability as a strength and an asset in how he operates. So I think we should all kind of sit down and wait until what his actual policy is going to be.
The same can be said, though, that we really don't know what Putin's going to do, do we?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we do know that Putin is sort of interested in, of course, improving relationship with the United States. And he believes he can do this. There's a higher probability of doing this with Trump in office rather than, you know, the alternative, which was Kamala Harris. And I suspect, I mean, we heard from the Kremlin this morning that, you know, Putin's spokesman basically said that we are open to direct negotiations with Trump as soon as Trump is ready to talk. So I don't think there's any question that Putin would like to speak to the United States about Ukraine. Kind of the unknown is, of course, is why Putin would provide any concessions at the moment when his forces are still kind of gaining ground in the east of Ukraine. It just kind of seems nonsensical.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the Ukrainians want to regain their presence in Crimea, and obviously, there's a large section of the Donbas that is now in Russian control. And as you just pointed out, I can't imagine they would cede that back to the Ukrainians by any stretch of the imagination.
No, and it's very low probability that that would happen. You know, Putin has kind of intimated again and again over the last 12 months that any negotiations will have to start out with the prospect of Russia holding the territory that it currently has. And in fact, he's actually demanding the Ukrainians withdraw from the entire Donbass region, in addition to two provinces down in the south that the Russians don't even have full control over. So, you know, whether this is a maximal negotiating position, or if he's actually serious about this, the only reason, you know, the only way we could actually find out one way or the other is by actually talking to the man and seeing if he's really ready to provide some sort of serious diplomacy, or if he's gaslighting us. We just don't know at the moment.
And as you said, kind of the cloak over all of this is this threat of becoming a member of NATO, and, you know, this neutrality issue that the Kremlin has put out there, saying, you know, that is something that has to be dealt with, that you are not going to be a future member of NATO. Obviously, they don't want that to happen, but either, right?
Right. And this is not only a position from Putin. I mean, presidents, you know, Boris Yeltsin, back when immediately after the Soviet Union collapsed, he had the same position. And the Russian political establishment, regardless of where you are on the spectrum of that establishment, they do not want Ukraine in NATO for understandable reasons. You know, whether you sympathize with that position or not is sort of irrelevant. But, you know, if you're a policymaker, you kind of have to understand where Russia is coming from. And the record is pretty clear. The Russians are not going to tolerate any security arrangement in which Ukraine is in NATO as a member state or even a de facto member state. And, you know, frankly, Ukraine is, it's always referred to as the kind of the crown jewel of the Soviet Union. And I don't think Putin has really kind of given up that axiom. You know, we're no longer in the Cold War, but Putin under Russia under Putin still very much values Ukraine as a central piece of the quote unquote Russian world. And of course, we disagree with that position, but we do have to understand it as we go through these negotiations or prospective negotiations.
I mean, when you think about it just from an agricultural standpoint, it's a huge win for the Russians to regain Ukraine, right? The breadbasket of that whole different area. I mean, if they had that, it would make life, it would make Russian life, I should say, a lot easier.
Well, I'm not sure if it's, you see, that's the thing. Why is Putin, I think that goes back to the central question, is why did Putin start this war in the first place, right? Is it strictly to gain territory? Is it strictly to basically capture Ukrainian agricultural land and kind of Ukraine's manufacturing capacity in the east of the country? Is it basically to shock the West into maybe rejiggering the European security, the security architecture over Europe writ large? It could be all four of those things, honestly. It's just very difficult to read a guy like Putin, who is obviously keeps his cards very close to his chest. And Trump, I will say Trump has a very, very hard hill to climb on this. He wants to clearly negotiate a settlement soon, within 100 days. And I heard a report yesterday that he's hoping the first 6 months of his administration, he's going to be focusing on getting a peace agreement. But, you know, there are no guarantees in negotiations, as he knows during his status as a private real estate developer. So he can have all the initiative and ambition he wants, but whether reality cooperates is an entirely different question.
One would agree, though, Daniel, that there are some things that are apparent, right? I mean, it's going to be hard to rebuild our military when we're sending billion upon billion upon billions of dollars over to Ukraine.
Right. And it's not only the money. It's, of course, the munitions that we send over to Ukraine. And I'm really speaking first and foremost, most about the anti-air and air-to-ground and air-to-air munitions that are really in short supply. The U.S. defense industrial complex is huge and has a lot of money, but it hasn't been able to produce these munitions to meet the demand that we have. And of course, you know, when people say we need to bring, you know, we need to send all these weapons to Ukraine, I always kind of try to remind them, well, you know, the United States is obligated through contractual obligations to send some of these weapons to Taiwan as well. So it's not just Ukraine that is receiving weapons. It's Taiwan. It's members of NATO and Europe. It's part of our friends in East Asia, Japan, South Korea. They all have orders as well, and that obviously places a huge stress on the U.S. and defense industrial complex. And the war is stressing it even further.
As you watch this unfold, how extended is our defense industrial complex?
Oh, it's very extended. I mean, some of the same munitions that the Ukrainians are asking for every other week, our allies and partners in Taiwan and East Asia are asking for. And we just, you know, realistically, we just don't have the bandwidth to supply everybody with all of the weapons that they're asking for and requesting. So it's certainly on the minds of people in the Pentagon who are responsible for making sure that orders are not only placed, but kind of, you know, implemented and finalized in a timely fashion. And this has been a longstanding problem, despite all the money that the Pentagon gets every fiscal year. But like I said, the war is a very intense conflict, very intense ground conflict, a war of attrition. And it's driving the Pentagon to quite frankly, to the breaking point in fulfilling a lot of these defense orders.
Who would be of our allies, because I'm totally ignorant of this, and it's why I'm asking, and I think it's appropriate to ask, is who would be the next largest defense industrial complex that's out there amongst our allies?
That's a very good question. I'm by no means an expert on defense industrial conflict, apparatuses across the globe, but I know the South Koreans have a huge defense industrial complex. And as a matter of fact, they've actually helped the United States with what they call 155 millimeter munitions, which is one of the munitions that the Ukrainians are sorely in need of as they defend their lines in the Donbass. Japan has an extensive defense industrial complex as well. But the problem with Japan is that their export controls are very stringent. So, you know, the Japanese are very reluctant historically and in terms of legally to actually export stuff to other countries, particularly if countries are in the middle of a war. That's still technically forbidden under Japanese law. So we do have partners with strong defense industrial complexes their production is pretty swift, but it's a lot of these legal problems that the Pentagon has been dealing with that kind of stymie distributing the weapons.
Yeah, because we do have to be mindful of our own inventory, right? And I know there's been a lot of criticism on the Hill about whether or not we're truly paying attention to our own stock here.
Right. And I think competing parts of the Pentagon are sort of at war with each other, you know, metaphorically speaking on this point. You know, folks in Asia are trying to remind people that are responsible for U.S. policy in Europe that, you know, Ukraine, as important as it is or as important as we think it is, it's not the be-all and end-all for U.S. national security. There are other priorities outside of Ukraine that deserve attention. And of course, you know, I'm talking about Taiwan and our position in East Asia generally, and even our maintenance and readiness on the home front as well. But these are all need to be taken into consideration. And I think sometimes we lose a sight of that.
Daniel, I've been throwing a lot at you this morning, but if you don't mind, I'm going to throw more. I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are of the signaling of what's going on relative to these ships dragging their anchors and yanking out internet cabling and, you know, fiber optic cabling that's running across ocean bottoms, you know, in the areas between China and Taiwan, obviously, in the North Sea as well. What do you take away from this? And is it signaling or of some sort?
I think part of it is signaling, I think a bigger part is just a continuation of what we call a gray zone tactics, which basically means penalizing an adversary or making the life of an adversary more difficult, but not going to the point of unleashing, you know, a war against that adversary. So it's a very low cost, high impact way to create problems for enemies and competitors, and you know. The Russians are very good at this, and they have a long history of doing this, going back to the early Cold War. They've been doing it to Europe pretty extensively, really since even before the war in Ukraine began in 2022. But you know, the Russian activities in Europe have accelerated pretty markedly since the conflict in Ukraine began, and it's a way for the Russians to hit back without risking a full-scale war against NATO. And I believe we'll probably continue to do that.
When we also look at, and I spoke to some folks the other day on the show about Chinese hacking, it seems as though this is some of, I guess those are some of the same gray zone tactics that you're talking about, right?
That's absolutely correct. And it's not only kind of putting our U.S. cybersecurity defenses on high alert, but it's also, of course, stealing information that the Chinese may be able to use in certain scenarios in the future. So, you know, with the Russians, it's very kind of reactive and retaliatory. For the Chinese, I think they use those gray zone tactics kind of in a more holistic way and in a more preparatory way. So both countries are very pro what they call, like, you know, disinformation tactics and sending operatives overseas to steal trade secrets. You know, both countries do it, but I think the Chinese are more capable over the long term, especially on the cyber front. You know, they've been stealing trade secrets from the Americans for well over a decade, two decades, three decades. It's really a long history of them doing that.
You know, it's interesting, as a layperson has kind of been watching this from afar, right? And I certainly don't know probably 1/1000th of what you know. But I feel kind of uneasy right now. This transition that we have from, you know, the Biden administration to the Trump administration, it seems like I wasn't familiar with that term, gray zone tactics. But as I look at that basket of that, it seems as though there's a lot more out there. And they're kind of testing the waters, seeing what the reaction is going to be. It just seems like we're kind of in a tenuous position right now. Your thoughts?
It's hard to know whether we have an increase in gray zone tactics or whether the United States is just better at sort of monitoring them and catching them in the act. You know, it's certainly hard for me sitting on the outside to determine you know, what the explanation is. But I would agree that, you know, during periods of political transition, you know, whether we're talking about the United States or even in European countries, regardless of what country we're talking about, political transitions can frequently be used by competitors and adversaries as periods of opportunity, right, to kind of see what our reaction would be. And testing a new administration in the beginning of their term is not new, and it's actually it's a part of statecraft that we have to be cognizant of.
And we actually have a lot of that going on around the world right now, right? In a lot of our allies, when you think of what's happening in Germany, when you think about what's happening in France, what's happening in Canada, and I'm sure there are others that I'm not even aware of. But there's a lot of that's revealing itself at the present time.
You know, we often say democracy is kind of the best political system that mankind has made up, and that is true to an extent, but it's also kind of a vulnerable system, right? Because it leaves open our autocratic adversaries in Russia, China, Iran, and to some extent North Korea. They understand that democracies are a little bit more vulnerable in certain places. That doesn't mean democracies don't have the strength to defend themselves. Certainly not. But it does leave open, another problem for aspiring leaders to pay attention to. And I'm afraid there's no one-size-fits-all answer to a lot of the problems that we're facing today. That's a regrettable part of it.
Absolutely. No doubt. Thank you so much for joining us, Daniel DePetris, Defense Priorities Fellow. Truly appreciate your time and your insight, and really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
All righty. We will be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us.